Welcome back to the IWA's podcast series, Wales, a Work in Progress, which seeks to examine and inform the ongoing debate around Wales's constitutional and democratic future. The IWA's ongoing policy project on Wales's constitutional future is supported by the Legal Education Foundation, and I'm Joe Rossiter, the IWA's Policy and External Affairs Manager. Today, we are back again with what should be a fascinating conversation with a knowledgeable and passionate person. So I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Barry. Now, Mark, I know you wear an awful lot of hats, but amongst them is Professor of Practicing Connectivity at Cardiff University. And of course, very well known for being at the forefront of driving forward the case for a South Wales Metro project. And indeed, it was a report published in conjunction with the IWA back in 2011 that made the initial case for the Metro. So welcome, Mark.
Now, welcome. Thanks for having me. Yep.
Now, this podcast is all about providing illuminating and informative discussion on the constitutional future of Wales. Where transport fits into the constitutional deliberations is the broad subject of our discussion. Now, we know that transport, with a particular focus on rail, is a subject for the Independent Commission on the Constitutional Future of Wales. But we want to kind of delve into why railways are an area of constitutional friction and what the evidence for constitutional change looks like on this issue. We also know that in order to create a sustainable transport system that's fit for the nation, both UK and Welsh governments have distinct roles to play in that. Whilst transport is devolved capability, many of the levers to achieve change sit at Westminster. Chief among these remain the fiscal firepower required for large-scale infrastructure projects. And this has also come out in relatively recent news over the last few years around Barnet consequentials and the complexity around that, and with the further reduction of the HS2 project, that and the designation of that project as an England and Wales project has several implications, not only political but also policy wise as well. So I want to start with a really broad question, because and we've seen the Welsh Affairs Select Committee in Parliament suggest as such that transport in Wales, and particularly rail in particular, is a very complex issue when it comes to the devolution settlement. So can you talk us through this complex web of capabilities when it comes to rail? So who has power to do what?
Right. So first of all, it is very complicated, and I don't think there's anyone who understands it all, me included, right? I mean, because we've built up layers of kind of bureaucracy and organizations and capabilities, both from a policy perspective, but also from an operational perspective over the last 20 or 30 years. What we have now is not fit for purpose, and I'll hopefully get into that. But broadly, at a very high level, the Department for Transport in London are responsible for the rail infrastructure in England and Wales on an England and Wales basis. The Department for Transport remit and fund Network Rail to do their bidding in relation to what they spend on the railways. It's worth pointing out that are probably, in respect to Network Rail, two main types of spending. One is what we call operation, maintenance, renewal spending, which is to maintain the railway in its current condition, to run as many trains as it does, as safely as it does, with a reliability level that actually is reflective of the funding as such. There's also something called enhancements, which is what you spend to increase the capacity so you can run more or faster trains or carry more people. Two different things, but they're related. A more enhanced railway requires more maintenance spending. You know, if you're traveling more trains on the tracks and there's more points being worn, you're going to need to replace them more often. So there's a link. The actual operational cost, the cost it is required to actually run the trains, which typically outside the main commuter routes in London, or maybe sometimes the main lines out of London, require a subsidy. Now, in Wales, the subsidy is the responsibility of the Welsh Government. That's not formally been devolved. Welsh Government has a responsibility for funding the Wales and Borders franchise under an agency agreement with the Department of Transport. So they effectively act as an agent. But the funding comes out of the Welsh Government funds for the Wales and Borders rail franchise. That's not all the rail operations in Wales, because you also have Avanti, you have Great Western Railway to provide some services. So there is some kind of blurring of the boundaries. For me, the bizarre thing about that relationship is that the Welsh Government are responsible for effectively the subsidy for rail operations on a rail network they're not responsible for investing in or maintaining or improving. And it's a situation, as a kind of a maybe metaphor. Imagine you're running a business and you're across the road is another business. You're responsible for the operational cost of running your business and try and sell the widgets you make. But the person across the road is responsible also for making and selling his or her widgets, but is also responsible for maintaining your capital equipment that makes the widgets.
Yeah.
And also his or her capital equipment. Now, over time, that individual's invested in their capital equipment to make their widgets more efficiently, make more of them, therefore lower the cost, but not in our kit. Yet we still have to maintain the operational cost of running that kit. Therefore, over time, those widgets become far more efficient and attractive to the market than the ones over here. Simply put, we have got a less efficient rail network, a less attractive rail network, in my view, because of probably 30 years of relative disinvestment relative to the rest of the UK on enhancements. And that flows through to operational maintenance renewals. Now, people say, oh, you're being critical. I'm not critical of anyone who works for Network Rail or a DfT or what they do. They're very professional organisations, but they've been established and remitted and organised themselves, even subconsciously, to focus on the way that the industry is organised. And that structure, that organisation, has systematically resulted in Wales being underfunded on its capital infrastructure, economic infrastructure in rail for 30 years. And I think this issue, I was on Radio 4 recently with Evan Davis talking about this. And I made the point, it's not just, I mean, Wales suffers and it's clear because the devolution arrangements provide the contrast. But if you're in Leeds or Bristol or Manchester, the capital investment in economic infrastructure, again, per capita, is been equally impacted. And if you look at the figures that the Treasury produces, the capital investment per capita in economic infrastructure in the UK has been far higher in London than anywhere else for a long time. The only place that's catching up now is Scotland. And I think possibly because it gets a very significant part of consequential for spend on high speed too. Wales has suffered. And I think that the issue for Wales, which I've been passionate about pursuing since I first gave evidence to Westminster in 2011, I might add, when no one was talking about High Speed 2, Barnett consequentials, or the negative economic impacts of High Speed 2. You know, I read the reports and I went up there on my own from Wales to kind of start making the case, which everyone is now much more aware of. But the UK's got a problem. You know, the levelling up rhetoric, you know, you can't level up with, you know, politically compromised largesse, as I call it. You need to properly, fundamentally look at where capital investment goes. And it really is disproportionately been spent across the UK for many years. And you've got to address the capital investment issues, you know, in Cardiff and Wales and the Valleys and North Wales and the North Wales mainland and Swansea Bay and in Bristol and in Leeds and in Manchester and in Newcastle in a kind of formulaic way. And we haven't done that.
And this comes from, you know, a discussion that is structural that goes far beyond, you know, whilst you say the HS2 Barnett consequentials and that being really impactful in Scotland, that is one instance that evidences a much larger structural problem for you in regards to Wales and rail.
Yeah, I mean, Barnett, again, as I learned, is more complicated than it first appears. I don't know whether I want to try and explain it here, but I've got a nice little video, which I'll maybe you can reference, where I try and explain how Barnett works in relation to the Department of Transport and High Speed 2 spend. Broadly, simply put, because High Speed 2 and all network rail spend, which is important, is defined from a Scotland perspective as England and Wales, Scotland gets a Barnett consequential for any change in the Department of Transport's budget. Whether that's from High Speed 2 or anything. And because from a Scottish perspective, nearly all of the Department of Transport spend is defined in England or Wales and none of it Scotland, it gets a very high, what we call a compatibility factor. So its population share times the compatibility factor means it gets a big slice of any change in the Department budget. Wales, on the other hand, because a larger proportion now of the GFT budget is things like Network Rail spend and High Speed 2, and they're defined as England or Wales, we only get half of what we should get for any change in the department's budget, non-devolved or devolved.
Yeah.
So it's squeezing us two ends, really. And that's had a massive impact. I mean, I've broadly, roughly calculated, and Welsh Government have published some figures. Broadly, I think we've lost about £3 billion since about the year 2000 on the relationship we have with rail and how Barnett works in relation to Network Rail spend and High Speed 2. Now, people can argue we get things for this and we get money for that, but that's capital investment in underlying economic infrastructure that we've not got a fair crack at a whip off.
Yeah, and we should say, you know, the Welsh annual budget for the entire Welsh government is around 24-ish billion a year, of which capital expenditure is a small slice of that, because most of that goes out the door in terms of statutory service delivery, whether that's majority of that being healthcare. So I want to come back to this, you know.
Just one thing on that. I think is people forget, because people often say, oh, Wales gets more per capita than other parts of England. The devolved settlement for me, and if you look at it, is we got power over those big departments that are spending departments, right? So they have money where they spend money, which actually have a higher per capita need than the UK average. We have an older, sicker population, and we have income and retirees. So the burden per capita is much higher in Wales before you start. And that's where most of our powers are, to spend money on those spending departments. We have limited powers on invested in underlying economic infrastructure, where actually the per capita spend has been far lower than the UK average and London than it needs to be and ought to be and has to be if we want to try and level up, if people are taking anything of that seriously.
Yeah, I think we've detailed this, especially in regards to the capital expenditure that is going to be required for large-scale decarbonisation of Wales' economy. You know,
yeah.
That is a significant challenge facing Wales, especially if we want to, you know, make sure that economic renewal more broadly, you know, that we're no longer older, sicker and poorer than the rest of the UK, you know, isn't, you know, there's nothing inherent in that about Wales's population. It's a factor of economic indicators that, and, you know, historical economic circumstances that has led to that being the case. So wanted to come back on, you know, you said very clearly, and this is really what the whole conversation is couched in, is in regards to currently the constitutional arrangements for rail specifically, not fit for purpose, you've said. Now, what is the solution to that, would you say?
Okay. What... Two things as well. I mean, just to add a bit more context, whilst government is responsible for transport policy, right? And it's come forward with its net zero Wales targets, it's COVID nowhere, the Wales transport strategy. It's made some pretty bold and controversial decisions on roads, 20 miles an hour. And actually, Via Transport for Wales, working with the regions, is bringing forward strategic transport projects across Wales. And it has quite a few other tools on the funding, operational cost, bus support grants, and we know about the challenge of the bus funding, but it doesn't have the tools in the box on the rail investment. Now, it compromises your ability to drive and deliver policy if one of the major tools in the box that you require to kind of enact that policy, you don't have. It's actually in the hand of somebody else, the bloke across the road in the factory, who actually has a different set of policy priorities.
Yeah.
And is doing things actually almost in the opposite direction on that. So, yeah, you can't deliver and execute the policy we have on net zero Wales in terms of decarbonisation. And the mode shift, and the mode shift targets are pretty startling and stark. So by 2030, if we take the target seriously, we need to increase public transport by 40% usage and double it again by 2040. I mean, that's enormous. That's going from the low levels of 4-5% to kind of 10-15% overall. And that still leaves car at kind of 50%. So car is still going to play a huge role. I mean, this is not anti-car, it's about just getting a better balance. But whilst those rail powers are at the DfT and the funding thereof, Welsh government's got no chance of delivering those net zero targets because it can't deliver the fundamental transport backbone on rail. It may be worth us getting onto the whole kind of rail versus bus thing as well at some point in this conversation.
Yeah. Because we can come on to that. And I think also, regards to transport emissions more broadly, you know, we've seen lots of other elements of Wales's economy, you know, since 1990, emissions levels have gone down in some areas fairly substantially. Transport remains broadly at the same level since 1990, despite all of these policy goals, which are, you know, on the right lines. But as you say, it's that implementation that is the problem. So do you want to come on to the buses? So speaking on buses as well, obviously they're the second half of the conversation around what the public transport looks like, and obviously that playing a key role in modal shift. We've heard from the Deputy Minister of Climate Change, he's flagged quite consistently how his ambition to reduce bus fares and, you know, attempting to go to a kind of single flat fare. But the reality of what we're seeing is bus routes closing following pandemic financial support falling away. And, you know, the Deputy Minister's kind of suggested that fiscal headroom from UK government is insufficient for delivering that kind of bus service that we want to see. So what are your thoughts on that? And then drawing that into that more substantial conversation around bus and rail, and ultimately both being two things that Wales is not particularly delivering on, despite them being a key plank of what is the transport strategy and wider net zero targets.
So there's a wider principle point here is, there's a devolution powers issue on rail funding. I think people have now got their heads around that, even across all parties. It's something not right. That needs to be fixed. But there's also an issue from a net zero perspective, that if you are going to be putting out there these ambitious targets on mode shift, which Welsh government have, and I know the Deputy Minister, you know, he's put his head on a block and put them out there. Yep. As a government, you can't be putting those targets out there and almost be cognitively dissonant in relation to the capital and revenue funding that goes along with that. You can't say we're going to have this huge mode shift on public transport or improve bus efficiency with more bus lanes and rail without actually having a capital program commensurate with that massive change and actually a revenue profile to subsidise those services. Now, that means you need to look at the relative priorities of funding between departments. And that's difficult because other departments are being squeezed and shored up. It may even mean that more existential conversation about why we actually subsidise car use so much. And people will say, no, we pay our fuel duties and excise duties, but you know that only covers a very small, probably 30% of the total cost of car use when you add in all the externalities. Mm-hmm. So there are some fundamental challenges on funding structurally about what net zero means and the implications thereof mean we have to actually probably spend a lot more. We need a capital program over the next 15 years that runs into the billions to provide the infrastructure. And we need to be thinking on additional, you know, revenue support for both bus and rail. Before I get into the bus and rail, let's look at a really good example, because what I don't want to do, and it's too easily done, it's not bus and rail, it's how bus and rail work together. Yeah. I mean, for me, just look at the differences. Rail, what rail does and what it can do and the outputs of rail are very different from bus. Now, it's a very simple example. If you want to move 1,000 people an hour between two points, do you want to move them on three or four trains or three or four light rail vehicles, right, with three drivers, or 15 buses, right? Mm. You know, 15 buses with 15 drivers, and that they're on probably roads with other congestion and not segregated. They're different outputs. In fact, the cost of running those 15 buses operationally will be more than running those three trains. But actually, in an area of much lower population density, where the corridor may only require 200 people an hour, we point this running one train an hour, which is half full, right, which is such a low frequency, it's not attractive to anybody. You're better off running those four or five buses that are more frequent and therefore more attractive. So the honest answer is you've got to understand that these things need to work together. Yeah. You know, the trains are the arteries of our transport network in urban areas. I think rules are a bit different. And the local bus networks are the capillaries. And the best example outside London of where a region took up this challenge and properly integrated was probably, I think, Newcastle in the late 70s, early 80s. This is before bus reform, bus route deregulation in the 1980s. The old rail network in and around Newcastle, very similar socioeconomic profile to Wales, you know, declining coal industry, you know, old freight lines not very efficiently used, was converted to create the UK's first biggest probably light rail network. And these things are all different. And a very, very ambitious program, which required a bit of tunneling in the middle of Newcastle, new bridge over the Tyne. But I think it was, 40 or 50 kilometres of, the numbers are somehow forgotten, of new light rail, using light rail vehicles. But the important thing as well, because they controlled the bus services at the time, that the Passenger Transport Authority, and that's another interesting thing that I'm going to reflect in my book that I'm writing on this subject, is that there was an organisation with a remit on regional transport and with funding and capacity and with responsibility at that time for buses. They redesigned all their bus networks to not compete with the new metro, but to kind of complement, integrate and feed it. So they created interchanges where those local buses didn't duplicate the routes of the metro, but they became the capillaries that fed the arteries that were the metro backbone. And they built an integrated transport network that by 1985 carried over 50 million passengers a year. And it was really very successful. It was huge, right? Then Margaret Thatcher's bus deregulation came in, the market rules came in, bus companies became freestanding organisations, were focused on the revenue. And, there were inefficiencies in public delivery of bus services, not pretend it was perfect before then. But the patronage overall of public transport in the Newcastle metropolitan area fell through the floor. It dropped to less than 30 million. And it really only started recovering pre-COVID and since about 2010. Because there was no kind of thinking mind, how do we join these things up, make these things work? So that for me exemplifies the importance of planning a network as a holistic whole and using bus where bus is the best solution. Yeah. And using rail where rail is the best solution and making them work together. So we don't duplicate, we don't compromise, we don't cannibalize our subsidy, which is what we tend to do in rails because of the nature of our fragmented bus networks or our rail networks. And that requires not just, I need to plan a new bus network, you need a completely different cultural approach. You need people in the transport planning world that kind of think about bus and rail together. Now, outside London, no one's done that since 1985, so they're probably about 95 years old. and they're probably not looking for work, right? So the people we need are those people who are either a very mode siloed or very spatially siloed. Yeah. And one of the challenges of Transport for Wales is not to be too heavy rail focused. Yeah. It needs to develop a planning capacity that thinks about all these things and how you join them up and use, where's the best to use rail, where's the best to use bus, how do we join them up, what's the rail bus interchange? And underlying that then, going back to the question on fares and subsidy, we need a fares policy that kind of can flow across the modes in a way that makes it attractive to use the whole thing. It can be difficult when you fragment it and look at it more in a more granular basis, because the cost of running one bus on a route is less than maybe operating one train. But we've got to think about how the whole thing fits together. That's much easier to do in terms of, you know, evening out the costs across different modes and services in an urban area with lots of demand. More difficult in rural areas. And we do have some very challenging bus rail services, let alone bus services. But that's the plan. The ambition's got to be an integrated transport network where we think holistically. Mm. And the opportunity for Metro for me is, you know, let's get the rail bit right. There's still some holes in that which we've got to fix. But how do we redesign our bus networks, not to compete, but integrate, support, and enhance to generate a network that is a single network? The passengers go, I get that. The tickets in the fares are the same. I can get on the bus, I don't know, up in Maradi, get on the bus, jump off a port, hop on the metro down to Cardiff Bay. It's single ticket, single fare. The bus networks are integrated. The services of sufficient frequency where interchange penalty is minimal or non-existent. And it works like the Newcastle Metro worked until 1985 when Margaret Thatcher's bus reforms basically smashed into pieces.
Yeah, I think you recognise that kind of more integrated transport network when you know, if you go on holiday to most of Europe, you notice that actually, oh, these are all considered one part of one holistic transport system. So I can get one ticket and I can get on a tram. I can get on a train for a more longer stretch. And it's cost effective to do the most sustainable thing. It's not, you know, you're not having a financial penalty for doing something that is what the government want you to do. So it's got to have that kind of financial element underpinning it as well, isn't it?
Yeah. I was at the Centre for Cities launched a report yesterday, which is very good, looking at, you know, we need to focus on investing in bus networks and integrating that. And someone noticed when they told someone from Europe about what we'd done to our bus networks, they laughed about what we'd done because they thought it was a joke. But they started crying when they realised it's actually what we had done. And we've made it so difficult. And you go to places that I traveled on a train last year, you know, my wife went down to Basel and down to Rome and back to Lyon. You know, just the ease of how you use these things, because they're all joined up, you know, they're all controlled centrally. There's a frequency there, there's the information there. I mean, Lyon was so easy, everything was tap and go. I mean, you didn't even think about the price actually, which is, you know, one of the risks. You don't know what you're paying, but it was all kind of just, it was much more consumable than actually in the UK, where, you know, I use the Cardiff Bus app. I like Cardiff Bus, and I was talking to Gareth yesterday. They got a tough job in a city full of congestion running reliable services. But the bus app's great. But if I'm at the bus stop, I got no visibility of the NAT bus or the stagecoach bus that might be coming through. And I'd like to be able to see all the buses, but there isn't an app that kind of properly does that. And so the information the customer gets is always very fragmented. We've got to try and simplify all that, so we've actually got the one network. And the vision of integration, you know, one ticket, one timetable, or whatever it was, it's going to be about the whole rail bus thing working together. And that's going to take a long time because it's a cultural challenge as well as a kind of a logistical and operational and timetable and procurement challenge.
Yeah, I think zooming out from the kind of constitutional question then, there are constitutional elements to both the problems with bus as much as there are with rail. Rail, you've obviously got those systemic, you know, challenges of, you know, fragmentation between ownership of who's responsible for what. For buses, it's much more on the nose of the wider fiscal challenge, especially when it's set amongst the net zero challenge. Now, I want to come back to something you've referenced a couple of times on levelling up, shared prosperity funding, UK government funds to replace EU regional development funds. And also, you know, obviously the Met's part of the Metro project is receiving some of this funds. So, you know, I just wanted to broadly ask the question of, do you think those funding mechanisms are working for Wales's transport goals? You know, are they enabling Welsh government to access money that is actually speaking to what Welsh government see as their transport goals as set out in Llwyfan Newydd or whatever?
I mean, there's two things. With your tactical hat on, you grab what money's available and do what you can do with it. Yep. But the reality is it being deployed strategically against the objectives and programs we have in place? And I think really probably not in some cases. I welcome it, but it's nothing like the European funding we had before. But there were always challenges and, about whether that was effectively deployed in all cases. But I don't think it works. You can't deploy this shared prosperity fund for a particular little transport component without reference to what else we're doing. Yeah. Where does this fit in? Is that the priority thing to do now? Or actually, is it fixing that first, then that first? And where does that fit in with the rest of the system? So it doesn't help a systems approach. Or how do you bring forward, maximize benefits, reduce capital to start with? So I don't think it does work. It's too tactical. It's politically motivated. Let's be honest about that. But again, if someone says, yeah, we'll fund that, and it's for something you know you want to do in the long term, so the Crossrail Phase 1, for example, it's something that we need to do in the long term, because when you fully connect that up and it's not funded for the full connection to the West, you double the network capacity, provide more resilience, you provide more reliability, and we are going to need more capacity if we take net zero targets seriously. Is that the most important thing to do now? I think, there are things on the Cardiff network that need sorting out, like getting the 4 trains an hour, which is we don't have, and half the city. And I'd be very critical about the fact that half of Cardiff won't be getting the metro, frankly, because half the stations will be stuck with 2 trains an hour. That needs to be fixed. But you'll take it because it's built into the future, but it's kind of a piece in the wrong order, maybe. That's all. So I don't think it does work, because what you want to do, you want Transport for Wales building its skills and capability and experience, bringing forward these holistic programs of rail and bus with all the powers, in place around the franchising to deliver the infrastructure we require and then providing the services that kind of builds the networks in a kind of sensible way to draw the demand without exposing us to either kind of peaks of capital or kind of holes in revenue, which is potentially what we could be doing with these things.
Yeah, I guess the regional nature of some of those funding pots means that it's a bit harder to kind of plan as a Wales-wide integrated network, potentially.
Well, it is a bit, but I mean, here's a question. People say, all the money goes to South East Wales, and I get that. On transport funding, the reality is you're going to need more subsidy per person outside South East Wales because it's less densely populated. Yeah. So actually, you should see subsidy per person higher outside, but a capital investment, because you get better utilization because of the population density, will probably be higher per person in South East Wales. That's just the nature of the way Wales is. What I think is an interesting conversation constitutionally for Wales, let alone the issue of London, which I think should be resolved and all the funding should reside here, is maybe allocating the funding by regions of Wales, and then within the regions make those decisions, but not just for rail, for the whole pot. Roads, rail, bus, subsidy, capital. There's your pot in North Wales. You decide. We've got these regional programs now. TfW provided the kind of foundation for the regional transport plans. What do we want to focus on? To get away from what we'll end up having is not the fight between Cardiff and London, then, and everyone else perceiving the Cardiff gets everything, which it probably doesn't, to be fair. But we do need to think about how that looks in Wales. And if we're going to have regional thinking and regional decision on transport policy and transport planning, actually, maybe the funding should follow on a population basis, what that looks like. And therefore, those CJCs have a bit of funding they can discharge. And then any kind of further funding, be it shared prosperity fund or whatever, can augment properly developed, constituted regional programs that have got things in the right order. And you contribute to the delivery of those programs over the next sort of 15 years. From a net zero perspective, we are going to have to spend, I think, between probably £3 and 4 billion by 2040 on more rail and bus infrastructure and active travel infrastructure. That would require more subsidy. If it could be done regionally and effectively without any of the politics that comes into play, and then any additional funding out of those other packages you mentioned, SPF and LUF, then they can just add to those pots of agreed programmes. That doesn't happen today. It's too fragmented.
No, and it's all about kind of setting up some mechanism that manages this that is sustainable and fit for purpose, isn't it? And if that so happens that is on a regional basis, then because those structures are being in the process of being created, and starting to roll out delivery, then that makes sense, doesn't it? So I want to have a kind of opportunity for a more optimistic close. We've spoken a lot about some of the challenges, some of the problems. You've also spoken about some of the opportunities as well. But what, from your point of view, are the opportunities available for constitutional reform and a transformation that's required of our transport system, and releasing all of the economic benefits that having a more integrated transport network would enable? What's the vision?
Let's be positive first, because I mean, I've taken on the role now of being probably a bit of a pain in the ass to people, because there's no point spending all this time slapping everyone on the back, because we've still got stuff to do. So I focus on what we haven't done and what we still need to do. But, you know, that was published by you guys in the Cardiff Business Partnership calling for a metro in 2011, right? Yeah. We're building a metro, right? Despite not having devolved powers for the metro, right? So, and so I'm writing a book about how that happened to understand the machinations of government to get to a point to decide to do that. That is a remarkable thing to be doing in Wales. Actually, compared to other international examples, pretty quickly, right? Really. I know we've had the COVID issue, we've had a bit of delay, and it might be 25 before we see the system fully up and running. But to go from heretical kind of musings by some crazy guy called Mark Barry in 2010, and building on previous work, I'm not being dismissive of some of the regional work of Souter and the kind of council and, you know, that it all kind of rolled into this program that we're delivering. So when we grab hold of a vision and it kind of gets, it catches fire, we can do it, right? The challenge now, of course, is we've got to find a way of finding the additional funding beyond £1 billion for the South Wales Metro to deliver these other things. So I think there's probably a couple of things that I think are going to be challenging. One is we have to honestly look at car use and the externalities of car use, and have the conversation about how we subsidise car use and how we need to address that and use some of whatever measure we put in place in terms of fiscal recovery of those externalities to help fund and support the capital and operational costs. Another thing I think is really important, as an example, my daughter asked me, just quickly, Dad, just tell me what cars have done to our lives in the last 30 years. And I said, well, lots of things, but here's an example. Since the 1950s, we've replaced millions across the UK of small, sole trader, independently owned businesses on high streets all over the UK. Basically, creating value, supporting their communities, retaining that value locally, spending it locally, everywhere. Right? We've replaced that with a few thousand corporate shed-based retail outlets on the edge of towns, employing people on often part-time or temporary contracts, or zero-hour contracts now. The value sucked out ends up on a balance sheet. No local ownership, no recycling of that value. And we've hollowed out all our high streets and replaced them with basically Tregore Mills, Cavarth Retail Park, and, you know, the old East and the Sainsbury's on the edge of our towns. And people are wondering what's happened to our high streets. You know, it's blindingly obvious what's happened to our high streets. And one little example, I think, for me, and this is all qualitative, someone could do the research in more detail than me. I have conversations with students about why is it Treorchy, which has its challenges, is a high street so different to Tonopandy. Yeah. Treorchy won the high street of the year in 2019. What? High street? Yeah. I mean, it's not for the hipster joints, right? It's just full of independent businesses that really have never been exposed to what Tonopandy was exposed to. Tonopandy High Street's been on its house for a long time. They've tried this, they put the parking in, the parking out. You know, it's struggled because actually, just up the road at Cluna Pier, there's a massive Tesco's. Now, that Tesco's attracts a lot of trade that would have been on Tonopandy High Street and from the area. No supermarket of scale wants to go to Treorchy. It's at the top of a valley, constrained catchment, difficult to get to. There's a little co-op up there. So Treorchy, because of its apology, has been protected by the 50-year impact of out-of-town shopping. Mm. So you can see what you can do. So for me, the challenge, you know, apart from that road pricing or reduction of discount, we've got to think about how we can encourage fiscally, working with, you know, retail park owners and investors. How do we move some of this stuff back? We can't move it all back because people still like to use heritage of sometimes car-based retail, but internet shopping is challenging that. But we can link this kind of transport agenda with a regeneration of a high street agenda, and again leads into another conversation about planning and transit-oriented development, because again, we still are, you know, approving developments that you can only get to with a car. I was at a developer conference. I was invited to a conference of, you know, the builders and developers. And they're talking about Breen and how, you know, the solar panels and heat pumps. And I said, yeah, it's great. It's a lovely house. It probably keeps all the heat in. But if you need to get in your car every time you want to buy a bag of sugar, it's not a sustainable house. Mm. And we still have thousands and thousands of houses being built in the wrong place. And we need to think about how we can densify. This came out at that conference yesterday that Andrew Carter was speaking at. We're too low density compared to many European cities in the UK. Even though Cardiff itself, you know, the core is relatively high density, even on the UK basis, one of the highest density places, it's still very low compared to Europe. And ultimately, higher density means you can serve more people more efficiently with public transport. Mm-hmm. But we've got to stop adding to the problem. One other thing, I think, from a government perspective, I talked about the funding, relative funding between other departments and transport. We still have government departments making decisions that are adding to the problem. So as much as Transport for Wales are emptying the bucket, there's a hole in the bucket that the health boards, for example, are putting by putting hospitals in places that are completely disconnected from the public transport network. Now, this is controversial. There's a debate over St Clair Station in our health board in West Wales and the cost of that station. And it's a non-devolved matter, so DfT should pay, but it's probably on page 47 of a list of priorities, even if it is a priority. There's probably £1 billion going to be spent on a hospital, perhaps in that area. I'd be saying to the health board, well, you're going to generate most of the traffic. You pay for the bloody station. Right. And this is the conversation that needs to be had at cabinet level. But the health board goes, no. We've done our transport appraisal and we think we can get away with four bus stops. And, you know, no, this is a major trip generator. Right. Yeah. Now, I'm not going to argue the merits from a health perspective of where the hospital location can be. But, you know, people are going to have to travel further from more places than having the two hospitals at Haverford West and Carmarthen. Therefore, they should be factored in that cost into their plans for the hospital. And these are the kind of planning changes I think we need. One other thing I picked up from a conversation is if Transport for Wales take on a more holistic role on developing transport networks, maybe they should become a statutory consultee for developments over a certain size. So the conversation would go something like, I'm Mr. Redrow, I want to put 5,000 houses over here. I need your approval, Transport for Wales. What do you say? So, well, you crack on, but we need £300 million for the tram line. Thank you very much. And they go, whoa, I didn't think we need to do that. Well, you can't build it then. And I think, bluntly, we need to be far more proactive and deterministic about if you want to build these things that generate this carbon emitting requirement to use cars, then you have to be on the hook for contributing, not just piecemeal for a few bus stops, a significant contribution to the capital required to provide the alternative to car use for those developments. We don't do that. Mm-hmm. So maybe TfW should be a statutory consultee in future. There's lots of challenges around transport that don't, and not just about transport, about the fiscal disincentives for car use, about planning, about how we regenerate high streets, but they're all interlinked. And I'm actually trying to pick up these themes in this book, what I'm trying to write.
Well, do you want to, you know, trail what the book is going to be about quickly?
Well, it's about basically two things. There's two parts to it. One is about my personal journey through the metro story from when I was a biotech entrepreneur, so I wasn't from a transport planning background. I had no idea about WebTag, WellTag, transport appraisal. I just thought, we're not very good at transport, are we? So I wrote this with the Cardiff Business Partnership, and we published that in 2010. That built the momentum for doing a metro. So I tell a story from my perspective of what I saw, what I felt, the meetings with ministers, with First Minister, with officials, good and bad, warts and all. And I've invited people to provide a counter-narrative because I think that the truth is there's no one version of the truth in a big story like this. Yeah. So it's trying to tell that story all the way to my view now, because I've had 10 years now. I think I know quite a bit now compared to 10 years ago. Not everything, and I'll always listen. But you haven't had those conversations with experts, you know, not just in Cardiff. I've been to Manchester and London and, you know, talked to chief executive organizations and different cities just to understand this. So there's that side. I also play in my understanding of the issue of cars and what that's done to our planning and our ecosystems. Looking at transport planning and choices. One thing about transport planning is, you know, you learn is there are no right answers. It's about choices and compromises. There are sometimes very clearly wrong answers, but you're often driven to make decisions based upon what your policy objectives are. And understanding it's about compromise. And you're never going to make everybody happy either. I get that. I've also got a section about transit-oriented development. And again, so a term I'd never heard of 10 years ago, but now I'm much more familiar. How do we encourage and create an ecosystem of planning that kind of enables us to build more stuff around our metro? I mean, it's pointless spending £1 billion on a metro if you're not going to get more stuff built around it so people can use it. You know, that's an obvious thing. And then the final thing, I muse on the future, the kind of things we should do in a way I did then 10 years ago and say, up next 20 years, we should do this. And I leave it with, these are the challenges, funding, fiscal, devolution, constitution. But I leave it underpinning this. I think that there's a UK problem constitutionally about not recognising the need to invest properly in economic infrastructure and addressing that on a UK level so that it's not just Cardiff and Wales and the regions of Wales can get an equitable slice of the pie, but Bristol and Leeds, Manchester, Newcastle. And I think the politics of this has to be framed that way because it's about, if we want to try and improve the economy of the UK in a sustainable way, in an equitable way, you've actually got to have a more formulaic means of discharging that kind of capital funding. Not at such a granular level as every street corner, but certainly, you know, the regions of England, Wales, Scotland, and probably within Wales on a regional basis as well. So I try and cover all of that. Probably poorly, and it's probably, you know, it needs a good proofread, a good kick. And I'm going to be bothering some publishers quite soon, I think, to see if they're prepared to take it on.
Brilliant. Well, I look forward to reading it, and I want to, thank you for your time and your expertise today, Mark. I very much appreciate hearing your thoughts and experience. I think it was a good chat that kind of touched on the not only the constitutional issues, but some of the kind of practical issues that have constitutional underpinning. So I think that's really useful as well. Just to say, if you'd like to hear more about the IWA's Constitutional Futures Project, please check in with the IWA's Twitter account, which is at IWA_Wales. We have lots of different events, podcasts coming up for 2024. So keep your eyes peeled. Just thanks once again, Mark, for your time.
Thank you very much. Move out.